It's January 24, 1984. The Flint Center Auditorium in Cupertino, California holds 2,600 people, and every seat is taken. Steve Jobs is standing on stage in a double-breasted suit, grinning. Behind him is a small beige box with a 9-inch screen. He's been rehearsing this moment for weeks, not just the demo, the pauses, the pacing, the exact beat where the audience should gasp. He reaches into his shirt pocket, pulls out a 3.5-inch floppy disk and slides it into the machine. The screen glows. A digitized voice fills the auditorium.
Hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag.
The crowd erupts. People are standing on their chairs. Jobs steps back from the podium, and the look on his face isn't triumph. It's vindication. 20 months of 80-hour weeks, a team he pushed past the breaking point, a board that's already turning against him. And in this moment, none of it matters, because the machine is speaking, and it's beautiful. This is a man who bends reality around his own conviction, and right now, reality is cooperating.
Bud Tribble, one of the original Mac engineers, had a name for this quality. He called it the reality distortion field, borrowed from Star Trek, the episode where the Talosians create entire worlds through sheer force of will. Tribble watched Jobs convince engineers that impossible deadlines were possible, that a machine with 128K of RAM could change the world, that beauty was a technical specification. And the wild thing is, it worked. Until it didn't.
16 months after this moment, Jobs will be stripped of all operational authority over the Macintosh division. 4 months after that, he'll resign from the company he founded. The vindication was temporary. The exile would last a decade. Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is episode 3. So that moment, the Macintosh speaking on stage, Jobs basking in the applause, the reality distortion field in full bloom, and the exile that followed. That's the emotional core of everything we're about to unpack.
Today we're doing Apple, Part 1, which covers the founding through the return of Steve Jobs in 1997. And I want to say up front, this is the most emotionally complicated story in the course. It's a story about genius and self-destruction, about a founding partnership that couldn't survive success, about a company that almost died because the man running it loved the product more than he understood the market.
And it's one of those stories where the same decision, closed architecture, integrated hardware and software, premium pricing, absolute aesthetic control, was catastrophically wrong for 15 years and then became the most valuable corporate strategy on earth. The question that keeps pulling me back in is, was Jobs right all along and the market needed time to catch up? Or did the exile change him in ways that made the same strategy work the second time when it failed the first?
I think the answer is both, but we'll get there.
We'll get there. It spans two episodes. Today is the rise, the fall, and the wilderness. Next time is the resurrection.
All right, trivia. This one is genuinely delightful. Before founding Apple, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak built and sold illegal devices called Blue Boxes that allowed people to make free long-distance phone calls by generating the tones that the AT&T switching system used to route calls. The question, who was their first customer and what did they charge?
The Blue Box era is so under-discussed. It's the proof of concept for the entire Apple partnership.
If you're playing along, pause now. The answer, their first customer was a fellow student in Wozniak's dormitory at Berkeley. They charged $150 per unit, and the parts cost about $40, 60% margins from a dorm room.
That margin profile is extremely on brand. The Apple pricing story starts before Apple even exists.
And here's the part that's genuinely wild. In one incident, Wozniak used a blue box to call the Vatican, pretending to be Henry Kissinger, and asked to speak with the Pope. He actually got through several layers of Vatican switchboard operators before someone became suspicious. He nearly reached the Pope.
The engineer who would build the Apple I nearly prank-called the Pope using an illegal telephone device. That's the sentence.
And the reason it matters, Wozniak said this explicitly later, is that the Blue Box was the moment he and Jobs realized they could build something with their own hands and control the entire experience, from the engineering to the sale. Woz could build it, Jobs could sell it. That dynamic, engineer and evangelist, builder and visionary, is the founding equation of Apple.
And like a lot of founding partnerships, the very qualities that made it electric in the beginning are the ones that made it unsustainable once the stakes got real.
That's exactly right, and we'll get there. Let's set the stage. Apple is founded on April 1st, 1976, by Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and a third co-founder who almost nobody remembers, Ronald Wayne. Wayne was an Atari colleague of Jobs, older, more experienced, and he drew up the original partnership agreement and designed Apple's first logo. He owned 10% of the company. 12 days later, he sold that stake back to Jobs and Wozniak for $800.
$800.
$800. Today, that 10% stake would be worth more than $350 billion. That's not a typo. $350 billion. It is, by any reasonable measure, the most expensive case of cold feet in human history.
I think about Ron Wayne more than is probably healthy. The man has said publicly he doesn't regret it. He was worried about personal liability because Jobs was taking on debt to fund the first production run. And Wayne had assets he didn't want to risk, which is a perfectly rational calculation that also happens to be the worst financial decision any human being has ever made.
It's somehow sadder that the logic was sound. He wasn't being irrational. He was being risk-averse in a moment that rewarded recklessness beyond anything anyone could have predicted.
So, the world in 1976. The personal computer doesn't really exist yet. The Altair 8800 kit was released in January 1975. That's the machine that Paul Allen saw on the cover of Popular Electronics, and that inspired him and Bill Gates to write BASIC for it. The Altair is a box with toggle switches and blinking lights. No keyboard, no screen, no storage. To program it, you flip switches to enter binary code. It's a hobbyist toy.
And the people who are interested in personal computing in 1976 are hobbyists. They meet in garages and community centers. The Homebrew Computer Club in Menlo Park is the epicenter. Wozniak is a regular. And the ethos is, this is important, profoundly anti-commercial. These are people who believe computing should be democratic, open, shared. The idea that someone would build a computer and sell it for a profit is culturally suspect.
Which is ironic given what comes next.
The hippies built capitalism's greatest machine. There's a whole book in that sentence.
What makes Jobs unusual in this world is that he isn't an engineer. He can't design a circuit board. What he can do, what nobody else in the homebrew world can do, is look at Wozniak's brilliant engineering and see a product. Not a kit, not a hobby project, a finished thing that ordinary people would pay money for. He's thinking about the packaging, the experience, the sale, before anyone else in that world has even considered the idea that there's a customer.
And the broader economic context matters. 1976, America is in the aftermath of the oil crisis and the recession. The technology industry, such as it exists, is mainframes and mini computers, big iron sold by IBM and DEC to large enterprises. The idea that there's a market for a small, affordable computer sitting on a desk in someone's home is considered by most serious people in the industry to be absurd.
IBM's own internal estimates in the mid-1970s projected that the total addressable market for personal computers was maybe 200,000 units. Total. Ever. They thought it was a rounding error.
Which is why they ignored it for 5 years. And by the time they responded with the IBM PC in 1981, Apple had already sold over 100,000 Apple IIs and proven the market was real.
But here's where I want to complicate the narrative a little. Because Apple didn't see the full picture clearly either. Jobs believed, from the very beginning with total conviction, that the right strategy was to control everything. The hardware, the software, the case, the fonts, the packaging, a sealed, beautiful, integrated experience. And that bet was wrong for a very long time before it was right. The incumbents were wrong about whether the market existed. Apple was wrong about what kind of architecture would win it.
I think wrong is too simple. Jobs was right about what a computer should feel like. He was wrong about what the market would reward in 1984. those are genuinely different things. So, Steve Wozniak is one of the great engineering minds of the 20th century. I don't think that's an exaggeration. The Apple Eyed, which he designed essentially by himself in 1976, is a work of engineering elegance. He minimized the chip count, the number of integrated circuits on the board, to a degree that stunned other engineers who saw it. Where other hobbyist designs used 100 chips, Woz used 30 or 40. He achieved this through a combination of genuine brilliance and an obsessive hatred of wasted components.
And here's a detail that shows you the kind of engineer Woz was. He would spend weeks redesigning a circuit just to eliminate a single chip. Not because of cost. At hobby-scale production, one chip barely matters, because it offended him aesthetically. To Woz, an unnecessary chip was an ugly chip. He treated circuit design like poetry. Every component had to earn its place on the board.
Jobs takes Wozniak's apple-eyed design to Paul Terrell, who owns a computer store called the Byte Shop in Mountain View. Terrell orders 50 units at $500 each, $25,000, the first real revenue. Jobs and Wozniak build them in the Jobs family garage, using money from selling Jobs' VW van and Wozniak's HP calculator.
And then comes the Apple II in 1977, and this is the machine that changes everything. Wozniak designs a computer that's qualitatively different from anything else on the market. It has a plastic case, not a metal box, color graphics, expansion slots so users can add functionality, a built-in keyboard. It looks like something you'd want in your home, not something that escaped from a lab.
And the business trajectory is astonishing. Apple goes from about $1 million in revenue in 1977 to over $100 million in 1980. In 3 years, the Apple II becomes the first mass-market personal computer. And the thing that drives adoption, the thing that transforms the market, is a single piece of software, VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet application, which runs exclusively on the Apple II.
VisiCalc is the killer app. It's the reason that business people, accountants, financial analysts, managers, start buying Apple IIs. Before VisiCalc, the Apple II is an expensive hobbyist toy. After VisiCalc, it's a business tool. One application transforms the customer base from tinkerers to professionals.
And this is where something interesting starts happening beneath the surface. The Apple II succeeds because of its openness, the expansion slots, the published technical specifications. Third-party developers can write programs for it. Hardware makers can build add-on cards. It's an open platform, and that openness is what attracts VisiCalc and what drives the whole adoption curve.
But Jobs hates the openness. He sees the expansion slots as ugly compromises. He wants a sealed, integrated, beautiful machine where every element is under his control. The Apple II is succeeding precisely because of the things Jobs considers flaws. And rather than update his mental model based on what the market is telling him, he doubles down on his instinct.
Oh, that tension between the open ecosystem that's actually driving adoption and the closed integration that Jobs believes is the future, that's going to define Apple for the next 40 years. And in 1977, it's already there. It's already in the room.
So in August 1981, IBM releases the IBM PC, and the ground shifts under the entire industry. IBM makes a decision that seems unremarkable at the time, but turns out to be one of the most consequential architectural choices in the history of technology. They use an open architecture, published specs, Intel processor, Microsoft DOS, a design that anyone can clone. IBM does this because they're in a hurry. They want to get to market fast, and building with off-the-shelf components and published specs is the fastest way to do it. They don't realize they're creating the conditions for their own irrelevance.
Within 2 years, Compaq has reverse-engineered the BIOS and shipped a compatible clone. Within 5 years, there are dozens of clone manufacturers. The IBM-compatible PC becomes the standard. And this creates an ecosystem dynamic that is incredibly powerful. Every new clone manufacturer adds volume. Every unit of volume attracts more software developers. More software means more reasons for the next customer to buy an IBM-compatible machine. It's a flywheel, and once it starts spinning, it's almost impossible to stop.
Now, before we get to the Mac, we need to talk about Lisa. The Lisa is Apple's first attempt at a graphical user interface computer. It ships in January 1983 at $9,995, a technical achievement and a commercial catastrophe. Fewer than 100,000 units sold.
The Lisa matters because it's where the Xerox PARC story comes in. In 1979, Jobs visits Xerox PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center, and sees the Alto computer, which has a graphical user interface with windows, icons, a mouse pointer, and Jobs completely loses his mind.
The engineers who were in the room said he was literally bouncing around, shouting, "Why isn't anyone doing anything with this?" He goes back to Apple and redirects first the Lisa team and then the Macintosh team to build a GUI-based computer.
And here's a detail that gets left out of the Jobs stole from Xerox narrative. Apple paid for access. They gave Xerox the right to buy 100,000 shares of Apple pre-IPO stock at $10 a share. Xerox made over $1 million on the deal. The problem wasn't that Xerox didn't get compensated. The problem was that Xerox management didn't understand the value of what their own researchers had built.
Xerox sold the graphical user interface for $1 million. The GUI became the foundation of a multi-trillion dollar industry. That's giving away the crown jewels for pocket change.
All right, the Macintosh. January 24th, 1984. The Flint Center moment from our cold open. And here's a detail about the pricing that I find fascinating. The Mac ships at $2,495. Internally, the engineering team had designed a machine that could have hit a lower price point. But Jobs insisted on the insanely great industrial design, the curved case, the built-in handle, the screen that felt like a face looking at you. Every one of those choices added cost. The $2,495 price tag wasn't just a margin decision. It was the direct consequence of Jobs' belief that the way a computer looked and felt was as important as what it could do. He was pricing in beauty.
And that price, for a machine with 128 kilobytes of RAM, no hard drive, a small screen, and limited software, put the Mac at a significant disadvantage against IBM compatibles that were cheaper and could run a growing library of DOS software.
The initial sales burst was strong. People were genuinely excited. But after the early adopters bought in, sales slowed dramatically. The Mac was a beautiful machine that not enough people wanted at that price. And meanwhile, the IBM-compatible ecosystem is compounding. Every quarter, the gap widens. More clones, more volume, more developers writing for DOS, which means more software, which means more reasons to buy an IBM-compatible machine, and fewer reasons to take a chance on the Mac.
And the thing that makes this so painful to watch in hindsight is that Jobs saw the flywheel building on the other side, and his response was not to adapt. His response was to believe harder. He was convinced that if the Mac was just beautiful enough, elegant enough, the quality would overcome everything else. He was running on conviction in a market that was being decided by ecosystem dynamics.
The numbers tell the story. By 1985, IBM-compatible PCs represent roughly 60% of the market. Apple has about 8%. And the gap is accelerating because the ecosystem advantages compound. It's not just that IBM-compatibles are winning. It's that winning makes them win more. And Apple, building everything in-house, controlling the whole stack, can't participate in that compounding at all. They're structurally locked out.
And here's the thing about choosing closed architecture in a market that's going open. You get quality control. You get margin. You get to optimize the whole experience. But you sacrifice the volume that attracts developers. And without developers, you don't have the software library that attracts customers. The closed bet only works if your quality advantage is so enormous that customers will accept a smaller software library and a higher price. In 1984, the quality gap between the Mac and a DOS machine was real, but it wasn't big enough. Not yet.
The conflict between Jobs and John Sculley comes to a head in the spring of 1985. And the psychology here is worth pausing on, because this is really a story about two fundamentally different kinds of leaders colliding. Sculley had been recruited from PepsiCo in 1983. Jobs himself recruited him with the famous line, "Do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and change the world?" Sculley was a professional manager, a marketer, someone who understood organizational process and quarterly targets. Jobs was a founder, a product visionary who managed through force of personality, and who treated organizational process as something that happened to other people.
And for a while, the relationship works because they need different things from each other. Jobs needs Scully's operational credibility with the board. Scully needs Jobs's product vision and reality-bending charisma. But by 1985, the Mac sales are faltering, the Lisa has failed, and Jobs' management style is alienating the engineering teams. The board is getting nervous.
And here's a detail that captures the dysfunction. In the months before the ouster, Jobs would walk through the Macintosh building at night after everyone had gone home and rearrange people's desks. He'd move engineers to different locations based on his own sense of which teams should sit together. People would arrive in the morning and their stuff had been moved. No explanation, no discussion, just Jobs reshaping the world at 2 a.m.
That's genuinely unsettling. That's not management. That's something else entirely.
It's the behavior of someone whose need for control has detached from any productive purpose. He can't control the market, he can't control the board, so he controls the furniture.
On May 31st, 1985, the board sides with Scully. Jobs is removed from the Macintosh division and given a vague title with no operational authority. He resigns from Apple in September and founds Next Computer. He's 30 years old. He's been running Apple since he was 21, and now the thing he built has decided it doesn't need him.
The next years are fascinating because they're both a commercial failure and the incubation period for everything Jobs will eventually do when he returns. The Next Computer is a beautiful, technically advanced machine, a perfect magnesium cube that costs $6,500 and sells about 50,000 units total. It's another gorgeous product that the market doesn't want at that price.
You see the pattern. Too expensive, commercial failure. Too expensive, disappointing sales. Next, too expensive, commercial failure. Three machines in a row where Jobs' insistence on premium design and premium materials produces a premium price that the market won't pay. At some point, you have to ask, is this a strategy or is this a compulsion?
The man had one gear. And the tragedy of the first act of his career is that the gear was right and the timing was wrong.
But the thing about Next that turns out to matter enormously is the operating system. Next develops Next Step, an object-oriented operating system that's genuinely ahead of its time. When Jobs eventually returns to Apple, Next Step becomes the foundation of Mac OS X, which becomes the foundation of iOS. The commercial failure produces the technical substrate for Apple's entire future. The $429 million Apple pays for Next in 1996 is really buying the operating system that will power the iPhone.
And simultaneously, Jobs acquires the computer graphics division of Lucasfilm in 1986 for $10 million. He renames it Pixar. Pixar will eventually produce Toy Story, go public in 1995, and be acquired by Disney in 2006 for $7.4 billion. Jobs' worst decade as a computer executive is his best decade as an investor.
What I keep coming back to is what the exile taught him about people. At Next and Pixar, Jobs couldn't rely on the Apple brand or the Apple reality distortion field. He had to learn to work with creative people, animators, storytellers, who wouldn't tolerate being screamed at. Ed Catmull and John Lasseter at Pixar taught him that you could demand excellence without destroying the people producing it. That's a lesson the 29-year-old Jobs was incapable of learning. The 30-something Jobs learned it because he had no choice.
Meanwhile, at Apple, without Jobs, the company drifts. Scully, and then his successors Michael Spindler and Gil Amelio, oversee a period of product line proliferation, declining quality, and eroding market share. Apple goes from 8% market share to 4%. By 1996, the company is losing money every quarter. There are serious discussions about selling to Sun Microsystems. Apple is 90 days from bankruptcy.
And then, in one of the most extraordinary twists in corporate history, Apple buys Next in December 1996 for $429 million. The stated reason is the operating system. The real reason, which everyone understands, is Steve Jobs.
Jobs comes back as an advisor, then interim CEO, then CEO. He cancels 70% of Apple's product line. He secures a $150 million investment from Microsoft, his most hated rival, to keep Apple solvent. And in 1998, he ships the iMac, a translucent, colorful, consumer-friendly computer that signals to the world that Apple is alive again.
Taking money from Microsoft, can you imagine how much that must have cost him emotionally?
Honestly, I think it's the most Steve Jobs thing he ever did. The old Jobs would have let the company die before taking Gates' money. The new Jobs understood that pride is a luxury and survival isn't. That's what the exile taught him. Not a new strategy, the same strategy, but with the pragmatism to keep the company alive long enough to execute it.
The man who was exiled for being too uncompromising comes back and is, in some ways, even more uncompromising. He kills most of the product line. He demands total control. But now the uncompromising vision is paired with a willingness to make the ugly tactical compromises, the Microsoft money, the product line cuts, that keep the whole thing from collapsing before the vision can take hold. We'll pick that story up next episode. So the story of Apple Part 1 through the Seven Powers lens is really about the powers Apple lacked versus the powers the IBM-compatible ecosystem possessed. And the starting point is the big one. The one that crushed them, network economies.
The one that crushed them.
The open architecture created a multi-sided network effect. More users attracted more developers. More developers created more software. More software attracted more users. Apple's closed system couldn't participate in this flywheel, and the consequences were devastating. By the early 1990s, there were tens of thousands of software titles available for DOS and Windows and a fraction of that for Mac.
And then there's the cornered resource question. Apple had one, Steve Wozniak. But Wozniak was a cornered resource that couldn't scale. His genius designed the Apple I and Apple II, but a company can't run on one engineer's brilliance forever. Wozniak stepped back from active involvement after a plane crash in 1981 and formally left in 1985. The cornered resource walked out the door, not because of mistreatment like at Shockley, but because the company had outgrown the scale at which one brilliant engineer could define the product.
And Apple's switching costs were real for existing Mac users. People who'd bought software, learned the interface, built workflows around the Mac. But the installed base wasn't large enough for those switching costs to be strategically significant. Having 10 million intensely loyal users is less valuable than having 100 million moderately loyal users if you're trying to attract the developers who determine which platform survives.
The developers go where the volume is.
Always. And then scale economies. IBM-compatible clones achieved scale that Apple structurally couldn't match. More manufacturers meant more volume. More volume meant lower component costs. Lower costs meant lower prices. Lower prices meant more volume. Apple, as a single manufacturer of a proprietary system, could never match the aggregate production volume of the entire clone industry.
This is why Apple's computers were always more expensive. It wasn't just that Apple charged a premium for design. It was that Apple's cost structure was inherently higher because one company can't outscale an entire ecosystem of competitors all building to the same standard.
The summary of Apple Part 1 is product excellence without structural advantage. The product was better, the strategy was worse, and in a market being shaped by network effects and scale, strategy wins.
That's a brutal epitaph for the most beautifully designed computer of its era.
Beautiful epitaph for a beautiful machine.
And speaking of strategic frameworks, if you want to apply Seven Powers yourself, the online course at svsstrategy.exyz has interactive tools where you can map out a company's powers and see where the moats are strong and where they're missing. There are also mystery company simulations, quizzes, and era context that puts you inside each decade. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley. strategy.xyz.
svstrategy.exyz, check it out. You know what I keep thinking about with the Apple story? The distribution question. Because I think that's the framework that explains the most.
Say more.
The IBM-compatible ecosystem didn't have better technology. It had better distribution. Being in every corporate purchasing catalog, every retail computer store, every university IT department, that's distribution and distribution compounds. Every existing installation is a reference customer for the next sale. Every IT department that standardizes on DDoS creates inertia that makes the next purchase easier. Apple had a superior product and an inferior distribution mechanism.
And distribution won.
Distribution won. The lesson is, product quality is necessary, but it's not a moat. Distribution is a moat. If you can't get your product in front of customers at scale, it almost doesn't matter how good the product is.
And this is why Jobs' return in 1997 was structurally different from his first stint. The first thing he did, before building new products, was fix distribution. He closed the clone licensing program that Emilio had started. He launched the Apple Store. He created a direct relationship with the consumer. He understood from the next years that distribution had been Apple's fatal weakness the first time around.
He spent the next decade building the distribution infrastructure, retail stores, iTunes, the App Store, that would finally make the closed model viable. But that's next episode's story.
And I want to connect this to the closed versus open trade-off, because I think it's the defining architectural question of this era. Closed systems give you quality control and margin. You own the entire user experience. You can optimize hardware and software together. You can charge a premium. But closed systems sacrifice ecosystem scale. You're one company against an entire industry of competitors, all building on the same open standard.
The bet on closed only pays off if the quality advantage is so significant that it overcomes the distribution and ecosystem disadvantage. In 1984, it didn't. In 2007, with the iPhone, it did. The variable that changed wasn't the strategy. The strategy was identical. It was the magnitude of the quality gap and the distribution mechanism.
Right, and I want to push on that distribution piece. In 1984, distribution meant getting into corporate purchasing catalogs and retail stores. Apple was terrible at that. In 2007, distribution meant a single carrier deal with AT&T and a single storefront, the App Store, that Apple controlled completely. The closed model didn't change. The distribution environment changed to favor it.
That's a genuinely important distinction. The strategy was constant. The context shifted to make the strategy viable.
So what does a founder take from the Apple Part 1 story?
The most important lesson is about timing and architecture. Jobs wasn't wrong about closed integration. He was early. The closed model, controlling hardware and software, optimizing the full stack, charging a premium for the integrated experience, produces a better product. The Mac was a better computer than any IBM clone, but a superior product in a market dominated by ecosystem dynamics will lose if it can't achieve sufficient distribution. The question for any founder choosing a closed architecture isn't, is our product better? It's, can we achieve enough distribution to sustain a healthy ecosystem despite our structural volume disadvantage? In 1984, Apple couldn't. In 2007, they could.
I want to add something about the exile, because I think about this a lot when I talk to founders who've been pushed out of companies they started. Jobs was fired, and the 12 years he spent in the wilderness, building Next, building Pixar, failing, succeeding, learning to manage human beings with something approaching empathy, were not a detour. They were the education. The Jobs who returned in 1997 was not the same person who was forced out in 1985. He'd learned that being right about the product isn't enough. You also have to be right about the people, the timing, the distribution, and the organizational structure. The first Jobs had one of those five. The second Jobs had all five.
And the near-death experience, 90 days from bankruptcy, is underappreciated as a strategic asset. When Jobs returned, Apple had nothing to lose. The board gave him essentially unlimited authority because the alternative was dissolution. That freedom, the freedom that comes from having no viable alternative, is what allowed him to cancel 70% of the product line, take the Microsoft investment, and rebuild from scratch. A healthy Apple would never have allowed that. A dying Apple had no choice.
The pattern I see in founders today is the best pivots come from companies that are desperate, not companies that are comfortable. Comfort is the enemy of reinvention. Apple's near death was the precondition for its resurrection. Takeaways, you first.
My first takeaway is about the difference between being right and being right at the right time. Jobs' vision of an integrated, closed, premium computing experience was correct. It is, in 2026, the most valuable corporate strategy on Earth. Apple is worth over $3 trillion. but the same strategy applied in 1984 nearly bankrupted the company. The technology landscape, the distribution environment, the developer ecosystem, and the consumer's willingness to pay a premium for design, all of those contextual factors had to align before the strategy could work. Being right too early is analytically indistinguishable from being wrong. The market doesn't give credit for prescience. The framework here is platform dynamics. A platform only thrives when it reaches sufficient density of participants, developers, users, complementary products, to sustain a self-reinforcing cycle. In 1984, the Mac never reached that density. The IBM ecosystem did.
That's sharp. My first takeaway is personal. I keep thinking about the founding partnership Woz and Jobs, the engineer and the visionary. I see this dynamic in almost every founding team I work with. And the question I always ask is, do you have a plan for the moment when your complementary skills stop being complementary? Because that moment always comes. The early stage needs both builders equally. The growth stage needs a singular leader. And if you don't have a conscious plan for how the relationship evolves, it'll end the way Woz and Jobs ended, with one person marginalized and the other ascendant, and a residue of resentment that never fully dissipates. The framework is founder psychology, the traits that make a founder extraordinary in the creation phase. Obsessive control, reality distortion, refusal to compromise become liabilities in the scaling phase. Jobs's intensity built the Mac. That same intensity made him impossible to work with once the organization grew beyond the reach of one person's will.
My second takeaway is structural. The closed versus open architecture question is the single most important strategic choice in platform markets. And the Apple story is the clearest illustration of when each wins and loses. Closed architecture gives you product quality and margin, but sacrifices ecosystem scale. Open architecture sacrifices control, but generates the volume that attracts developers and creates network effects. Apple in 1984 to 1996 is the textbook case of product excellence without structural moat. The Mac was demonstrably better, and it lost. It lost because product quality without network effects, without scale economies, without the structural mechanisms that convert quality into competitive durability, is a niche business at best. The framework to carry forward: product quality is necessary, but not sufficient. Structural power, the kind that compounds, is what separates a great product from a great business.
My second takeaway is about the value of exile. Jobs spent 12 years in the wilderness and came back a fundamentally more capable leader. Next, taught him about operating system architecture. Pixar taught him about storytelling, about managing creative people, about the patience required to build something over years rather than months. And both taught him about failure, about what it feels like to pour your soul into something and have the market reject it. When he came back to Apple, he had scar tissue that the 29-year-old Jobs didn't have. And that scar tissue was what allowed him to make the brutal, unsentimental decisions. Killing product lines, taking Microsoft's money, firing people he'd hired the first time around, that saved the company. The exile wasn't a punishment. It was the tuition.
Before we go, if you want to experience the Apple story from the inside, the online course at svstrategy.ex, YZ has an AI role-play scenario where you sit in Steve Jobs' chair during the 1985 board meeting. You make the decisions before seeing what actually happened. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz. We'll see you next time.
Next time on the show, Microsoft, Bill Gates, the QDOS acquisition, the bundling wars, the antitrust case, and how the nerdiest kid at Lakeside School, an elite private school in Seattle, built a monopoly, lost the mobile era, and then staged the most improbable corporate revival of the 21st century under Satya Nadella.
We've been building to this one. IBM made the architecture open, Intel made the chip, Microsoft made everything else.
And we finally get to meet the man who saw the whole board before anyone else sat down to play.
Gates is going to be fun to analyze.